and technology from where they've been to where they're headed.
So think big.
Big picture science.
Saturday evening at 5 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Today we want to spend some time talking about guns, which most people know have played a very big role in the life and development of this country and still do. In a few minutes, we'll talk about an aspect of the civil rights movement that you might not have heard. Author Charles E. Cobb Jr. explains why he says guns made the civil rights movement possible. He has a new book about that. But first, we want to talk about a story that shows how much guns are a part of life and a part of our consciousness right now. Some gun rights advocates are getting national attention for what are known as open carry demonstrations. That's when groups of gun owners meet in a public space, sometimes at marches or in stores or restaurants, carrying weapons in full view. The National Rifle Association's lobbying arm originally called the movement counterproductive, weird, and, quote, just not neighborly. The NRA has since backtracked on that comment, but some businesses are fighting back and resisting this push to allow people to bring their weapons into their establishments. And that caused writer Dahlia Lithwick to ask if this debate is having a broader influence over our bigger conversation about guns. She covers legal affairs for Slate, and she wrote about this recently. Welcome, Dahlia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us to talk about open carry protests in Texas is Wayne Slater. He's the senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. Wayne, welcome back to you as well. Thanks for joining us once again.
Great to be with you.
So, Dahlia, could you explain what open carry laws are, briefly, if you would, because I know that there are a number of them, and talk about, you know, where they're in effect and what kind of what's that sparking?
Well, it's really, we've seen a lot of this is based in Texas. Open carry laws are essentially laws that say that you can openly carry in Texas. We're talking about long guns, as long as you know, you've met certain requirements. And what it's sparking is this notion of open carry demonstrations. So this stops just being a state statutory question. It starts to be a First Amendment issue, where folks in open carry states say, look, if we're allowed to carry our AR-47s in public spaces, we're going to make a First Amendment statement that, A, we're allowed to do this, and, B, you should get used to it and not be afraid of it. Hmm. And that's the part that, as you say, is sparking some controversy, because a lot of folks who are subject to the so-called open carry demonstrations say, wait, I am scared of this. I don't feel safe in this environment. And so what you're really seeing is a conflict between the First Amendment sort of demonstrative rights of open carriers in states where it's legal in conflict with the feeling of public safety, particularly in this case, mothers of young children in a bunch of restaurant chains. And so this has turned into a big fight about whether you have the right to do it as opposed to whether it's smart to do it.
So when you talk a little bit more about that, what does that track with you with what you're seeing in Texas? Like, why are people all of a sudden wanting to carry these? And we're not talking about like the kinds of a 9mm, like a handgun that people are used to seeing with people in law enforcement or security officers. We're talking specifically about long guns, Wayne.
Yeah, we are, and I think Dahlia's got it exactly right. This collision of values, First Amendment versus sort of an attitude about the Second Amendment. And then also the collision of private property rights. That's another sacred right in a sort of conservative state like Texas. So on the one hand, if you have the right to carry around your rifle, and you do, there's no specific law in Texas that says in an open space that you can't, then it's not only the question of, is it smart? In other words, is it counterproductive to the larger goal of encouraging a broader attitude about gun rights? But is it also bad for business? And a number of businesses in Texas who are, I guarantee you, headed by very strong, conservative, valued business folks think in some cases, this isn't smart to have some guy with an AK-47 in the baby food aisle of Target. That just isn't good for business.
How has that been playing out? Have businesses been specifically telling people they can't come in? I have to tell you that, you know, I was last in Texas for a book conference, and I was wandering around before my session and noted that there were a number of bars that had signs very prominently saying, you know, no guns in this bar. And you can sort of certainly understand why people feel that perhaps, you know, alcohol and guns don't mix. But so are they specifically barring people from bringing these guns in? Are they requesting? Are they suggesting? Are they reaching out to the people organizing these movements? What are they doing, Wayne, specifically?
There are really two things. One is, with respect to bars, there is a specific provision in the state concealed weapon handgun law, the law that allows people to carry guns into all kinds of places so long as they are concealed. They're not allowed in a few places like schools and bars, places where you sell 50% or more of the take is alcohol. But this is really a larger question here with respect to the long guns or open carry, openly carrying a gun. And what's happening is in some of these places where the law doesn't specifically say you can't do it, the businesses are asking them, places like Chipotle, places like Sonic Drive-In, places like Target, where the owners of these businesses are in effect saying don't do it. And ironically...
Well how are they enforcing that, though? I mean, so what are they doing? Are they saying we would prefer that you not, or are they saying you can't come in if you do? What are they saying?
What's happened basically here so far is these open carry advocates, generally speaking young men, look like they're, I don't know, characters from the movie Knocked Up or something. But these guys who very, very strongly support gun rights say that they're letting the managers of these companies know before they show up. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. In a few cases, and I've seen some video, Dahlia has written about this, where in Texas and a couple of places, the waiter or someone at a restaurant has come over to the folks who are sitting there and saying, we're sorry, we will not serve you. We are asking you not to stay here while you're holding long guns and scaring the rest of our patrons.
You know, to that end, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about open carry protests or protests against open carry laws, and people trying to make a demonstration by specifically carrying long guns into establishments. And our guests are Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News and Slate legal affairs writer Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, to that point, you wrote about the fact that in one restaurant, the people working there thought they were being robbed, and they weren't serving anybody because they ran and hid when they saw somebody kind of walking in with these guns, which sounds funny, but you can imagine if you were on the receiving end of that, you would not find it funny at all. But you were suggesting in your piece that businesses resisting this desire to accommodate this could be having an effect where sort of organized political activism around gun control is not. Could you talk a little bit more about your thoughts about that?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right, Michelle. I mean, the point of the piece was, I think, you know, in the wake of the tragic shootings in California, you saw another rise and fall of an effort to, you know, maybe this time we can get meaningful gun reform enacted. And it never quite takes off. We learned that after Sandy Hook. You know, even when public opinion is at 80-90% for certain initiatives, they cannot get passed legislatively. And the courts, I think, have done a lot to push the idea that Second Amendment rights are personal and that people do have the right to carry guns after D.C. versus Heller was decided at the U.S. Supreme Court. So the point of my piece was, if this can't get fixed legislatively or judicially, maybe it's just going to get fixed by rational actors in the free market saying, that's fine, Chipotle, when the rubber hits the road, we will not go to your store if you have an open carry policy. And as Wayne said, we've seen in Texas in a very few short weeks, Chipotle, Starbucks, Chili's, Sonic have all issued statements that say, you are not welcome to bring your long guns here. And I think that we may just see rational actors pressuring businesses. Right now, Target is being pressured very hard by the same group, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, very, very hard to make a similar statement about you can open carry wherever you want, but not in the baby aisle at Target. So I think we may see some change happen just because the market responds to rational actors in ways that government doesn't.
But wait, what about that? I mean, I still need to press on this question that, as I understand it, that these business owners are not barring people with this, you know, who want to carry long guns in their stores. They are requesting that they not come in, which is interesting. I mean, when the rubber hits the road, at some point, if one wants to test the theory, it has to be enforced. So how far are these businesses willing to go to say, this is not we are not accommodating this. I mean, I think some people are familiar with things like dress codes, right? For example, at certain establishments, they'll say, well, you know, you can't bring your saggy pants in here, or you can't, you know, you have to wear shirt and shoes, you know, that sort of thing. And people are pretty accustomed to having that enforced. But I don't know that people have litigated on this question specifically. So Wayne, how far do you have any sense right now of how far businesses are willing to go to enforce this, what seems to be a request?
I think there are a couple of things, and one of them is in terms of the rational actor policy, that businesses, so many of these businesses, by encouraging that, really have the public on their side. Even in a gun rights loving state like Texas, where people, again, think that independent private property owners, the business certainly has the right to do this, and even more rationally, normal Texans, even those who are very strongly supportive of Second Amendment rights, say, this is kind of crazy and scary to have somebody there. So I think I think businesses will push the matter. There is a slight there is a provision in law, although it doesn't explicitly say you can't carry your long guns around most places. There is a provision in law which has been used right now, and it has to do not with explicitly the guns on private property or in businesses or, in this case, the Texas Capitol. Right now, I can carry a gun into the Texas Capitol if I want to. I have a concealed weapon permit, and I can go right in with my permit and carry a gun. Theoretically, I could carry a long gun into the Capitol. But the DPS, the Department of Public Safety folks, have let me know and others know that if anyone tries to do that, and frankly, I don't know of anyone who has tried to do it, they will be stopped because you are creating a potential disturbance. And it's an odd way. It's almost like going after the mafia with tax violations. But in effect, if you go to a place and you are creating a disturbance, there is a legal provision, a legal right that a business can right now call the police and on good legal grounds, sound legal grounds, say, these folks shouldn't be here. But one last thing, and that's that politicians who need to kind of thread the needle on this, many rational politicians in Texas are beginning to say, we love gun rights, but we sure don't think this is the right way to promote it.
That was Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. He joined us from KUT in Austin. Dahlia Lithwick is legal affairs writer for Slate. She joined us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Her piece was titled, Not in My Backyard, The Courts and Legislatures Won't Solve Our Gun Problem. Maybe the Free Market Can. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the NBA Finals kick off today with Miami versus San Antonio. But while Miami Heat star LeBron James is fighting for the win, he's also winning influence off the court. New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden talks about how King James is making a mark and whether he's setting an example for other athletes to speak their minds. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. We've heard from two valedictorians this week. Tomorrow, we'll wrap up our series with a West Virginia student who's dealt with a very unstable home life.
I knew that to overcome the obstacles that I had in my life, I knew that I had to go on and get a post-secondary education.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays, starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The NBA Finals begin today with the Miami Heat facing off against the San Antonio Spurs. And, of course, attention is focused on Miami's star player, LeBron James, as he fights for his team to collect their third NBA title. But our next guest says there's something else to watch, his growing influence off the court. He was one of the first voices to call for the ouster of L.A. Clippers owner Donald Sterling after Sterling's racist comments were made public. Here's LeBron James.
We're fighting to get an owner out of our league that shouldn't be a part of our league. And no matter how long it takes, no matter how much money it costs, we need to get him out of there.
Now, it's been rare for a star player to get involved in politics and speak out against authority, especially players involved in a team sport. But according to sports columnist William Roden, he says that LeBron James is breaking that mode. And William Roden is with us now to tell us more about that. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
It's my pleasure.
Now, I think a lot of people might remember John Carlos and Tommy Smith at the 1968 Olympics giving their Black Power salute on the medal stand in Mexico City, for which they paid a very heavy price, by the way, it has to be said. But for the most part, you were saying in your piece that players in team sports have generally refused to get involved in racial and political issues. Why is that?
Lack of courage, lack of conviction, lack of critical thinking skills in college, where most of us learn our critical thinking skills. That's sort of the irony and the problem of this of the big time college sports industry, where people are pretty much passed through in big time football, big time basketball, and they really don't really embrace the college experience. They just kind of get passed through, and they really never develop those critical thinking skills. And they're also taught from an earlier age in AAU basketball and youth football that the best way to make it through the system, particularly if you're a young Black kid, is just to put the blinders on. Don't look left. Don't look right. Just go straight ahead. Stay on the conveyor belt. Be a good boy and don't make waves. And perhaps you'll reap the fruits of your silence. And I think Michael Jordan became the signature of that approach by not making waves, by promoting, making you look at him.
His business interest, his commercial. Well, you reference this in this piece. Remember, he's from North Carolina. He was asked to get involved in a campaign where an African-American candidate was running against Jesse Helms, a conservative and who is running a kind of a racially divisive campaign. And Jordan famously was said to have said, well, right. Republicans buy shoes, too. Did that set a certain tone for other players to say that you should focus on your commercial interests as opposed to any kind of broader political or social interests?
Yeah, of course, Michelle. I think that had he done what Smith and Carlos did, because everybody was looking for Jordan, as they're looking to LeBron, for direction to set the tone. And his tone was, hey, look, just take the money and run, keep your mouth shut, and endorse those products. He set that tone, which is so interesting about LeBron, in that I think, it's a different era, it's a different age, but courage is generational. And I think LeBron realized, back in Cleveland, when he decided, I could choose where I want to play, making a statement about Sterling, he said, what are they going to do to me? I'm the guy. And telling, by extension, telling players, look, guys, we are the league. If there is no players, there's no league. And even looking at
that was true of Michael Jordan, too. I mean, he was the biggest. He was the face of the league for so long.
He didn't think that way, though. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
he chose political neutrality.
But what I'm curious about is why you think LeBron James has taken this tack at this particular point in his career. I was wondering whether you saw signs of this inclination at an earlier point in his career.
Really, Michelle, to me, the first inclination was doing the decision. When he decided to take ESPN up on his offer and say, yeah, okay, I'll roll with that. But more when he decided to leave Cleveland and exercise his right, not just as a free agent, but to choose where he wanted to go and do it in alliance with other star players, recognize that we've got the muscle. We can do this. And I think the next level is going to be now that they've seen how these franchises are being sold for, like $2 billion. It's wait a minute. We should be able to get a portion of those proceeds. And I'm hoping that that's the next level of I don't want to call it protest, but insight maybe it is protest at the next bargaining negotiation for the players to say that, wait a minute, when these franchises are sold like this, the players should get a portion of the proceeds, not necessarily us, but it should go to the NBA Players Association for, let's say, retired players. But So I'm looking, going forward, I'm looking for LeBron's influence to gain. That's why I'm pulling for the Heat, by the way.
Okay, duly noted. You know, I noted in your piece that you mentioned that 2 years ago, James took a photo with his Heat teammates in hooded sweatshirts in an effort to bring awareness to the fatal shooting of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. And that was a moment that stuck out for some people. Also because this was not an issue that was specific to basketball.
Right.
I do want to mention that, you know, there are other people in other sports. I'm thinking about the NFL kicker Chris Clouie, mm-hmm. who believes he was not picked up by another team for another season because of his decision to speak out in support of same-sex marriage as an ally, noting that he is not a gay man himself, but he felt a responsibility for reasons that he has made clear to speak out in favor of this issue. I have to ask whether you think, and obviously people disagree that was why he wasn't picked up, but he believes that to be the case. Do you feel LeBron James in a different position because of his dominance in his sport, or because so far he's really kind of focused on issues that are specific to his job, which is profession, which is basketball?
Well, yeah, LeBron is in another universe, Michelle. I mean, you know, I mean, no, a lot of people don't know Chris Clouie. Everybody from China to Senegal to everybody knows LeBron James. If LeBron made the same statement about same-sex marriage, people would stop and listen. I'm not saying that they'd all follow, but they'd stop and listen. So it's not just sports specific. It's the idea that LeBron James, a person who's known universal, is taking the blinders off and is looking around his surroundings. Remember, just before the Olympics, when he was going to China, people were asking him about human rights issues in China. And he actually said, you know, when I get there, I'll consider, you know, I'll do my due diligence and I may say something about it. I think what happened is that the coaching staff and probably some people from the government kind of got to him and said, listen, that's not the time, you know, let's not do that. But it's on his radar. And I think that my impression of LeBron in terms of his evolution, he's more like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in terms of being headed toward being a Renaissance person who's looking at things beyond, as you said, his sport or his particular circumstances. But we'll see. You know, we'll see.
A final question. LeBron famously went to and started playing professional sports right after high school. So one of that kind of loops back to the beginning of our conversation is, you know, your argument about why a number of these players have not been more outspoken in the past is that they are actually lightly educated, despite the fact that many of them actually did attend college. But you're saying that they really didn't absorb the college experience. Does LeBron James have anyone advising him or helping him shape his thinking in some of these areas? Briefly, if you would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that not going through that educational system probably helped him. And he's got a team. He's got an independent team of people, some people he grew up with. He didn't go the traditional route of the huge agents and the huge law firm. So from the very beginning of his career, he set the tone. I'm going to be an independent thinker and an independent athlete.
William C. Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times. He was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. We've been talking about his piece titled NBA's On-Court Leader Embraces Off-Court Mantle Without Fear. Bill Roden, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Michelle.
June brings basketball championships, but also weddings. And when the big day comes for engaged couples and their families, often the only thing more overwhelming than the love is the bill, especially in cities like New York, where the cost of everything is high and logistics can be a nightmare. So the story of one New York couple might give other lovebirds inspiration. Nasikle Akweta and Kyle Healy organized their wedding using almost exclusively online startup companies, and it looks as though they will be able to tie the knot for less than $10,000 in a city where the average wedding is, wait for it, 9 times that cost. They were profiled in a recent story in Fast Company magazine, and the happy couple is with us now. Welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
So before we get started, you know I have to ask how you met.
So Kyle and I actually met on OkCupid.
This is the start of our internet romance.
OkCupid. Okay, so who saw who first?
I saw Kai first, yeah, and messaged him, and he responded, thankfully.
So how did you come up with this idea of kind of trying to do it this way? Was this just a natural for you, or was it that you kind of researched the traditional ways of putting on a wedding and thought to yourselves, you know, I kind of don't want to be in debt for the first 5 years of my life, and we got to do something else?
So we had a pot of $10,000 for this ceremony, and
based on what we could scrape together and what, you know, obviously sometimes parents can chip in, which we're very grateful for.
So you knew what your budget was, which
exactly.
is a good, which is also a good thing.
And we decided we were not going to go into debt to get married and start our life out that way, as you said.
And for the most part, venues start at least like $5,000, which we didn't want to do. And in addition to being kind of expensive, they put constraints on you with regards to which caterers you're allowed to use. So I think right off the bat, we felt like we wanted to find a better alternative to that. And so we came across Airbnb. And after we made that decision, which was like kind of a pretty huge diversion from the norm, I think things just kind of organically sprung up in different tech startups that we started to notice.
How did Airbnb help you? Because what, you were able to find a space where you didn't have to have all these restrictions?
Yeah, exactly. So you can search apartments by number of people that they can house, features that are available to them.
We wanted outdoor space.
Exactly.
That was very important to us to have like a, optimally, like a rooftop garden party experience.
And so you found a rooftop. I won't disclose the location.
Thank you.
We'll follow the Jay-Z Beyonce rule. We'll just keep that all very private. I understand that you also used TaskRabbit to find staff. How did that work?
Yeah, TaskRabbit was hugely useful. We found a photographer, cater waiters, a cook for the brunch the next day that we're also hosting at the same Airbnb apartment, cleaners at definitely a fraction of the cost it would have taken to have like a proper crew come up and do that for us.
What about the food? Kind of important.
That was very important. That's right. The food was very important, and that's one of the reasons that we decided to save on the other costs so we could really go all out when it came to the food.
How is that going to work?
Good question.
So for the ceremony itself, we're ordering from one of our favorite barbecue places and having a TaskRabbit pick it up for us. And then for the brunch the following day, we've ordered from Instacart, which is kind of like Peapod, but it delivers from a number of different grocery stores, which is kind of important because we don't have a Costco membership, for example, and they can pick things up from Costco for you. And they can also deliver alcohol, which was useful.
Very useful.
So we're having all of those delivered to the apartment and then having the TaskRabbit cook for us.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. Now, are there any downsides to this? I can imagine that generally with weddings, you invite family members of different generations. Everybody's not as computer savvy as perhaps, not stereotyping, because the fact is we do know that there are a lot of seniors who are very tech savvy, but sometimes that kind of varies across the board. Have there been any people in your kind of universe who've had trouble with the whole thing? Have you had any difficulties there?
Yeah, actually, one of the sites that we used was Paperless Post for the invites, which you think is, you know, just lickety-split, 1, 2, 3, put everybody's email down and blast it out, and everybody can respond on their, you know, on their own time, and we get their feedback instantly. But it turns out that some of the older generation were not on the email so much. So...
And then similar to that, we have our wedding website on The Knot, and pretty much all the information that you could possibly want is there. I talked to my mom last week, and she still didn't know that she had to book a hotel room. So, like, things like that where...
Mom doesn't have a hotel room?
But, yeah, things that I didn't really think of have popped up as problems, it turns out.
Well, it makes sense, though. So kind of on the leading edge of this kind of experience, I think a lot of people are used to maybe doing one or two things online, but trying to make the whole thing that way, you know, kind of new. So we are certainly wishing you well. We're certainly hoping all goes as you hope. I'll just tell you right now, it won't, but you'll be okay. If you were not to give this advice to other couples who are starting out on this, are there kind of one or two things you would really want to flag?
So actually, we've been trying to be pretty flexible with this entire thing. And so a new technology that we came across actually this week is called PixoBook. A problem that I've had going to weddings in the past is that I'm taking pictures, all of our friends are taking pictures, but the bride and groom never see them. And so PixoBook is going to help us reach out to the guests and scrape through like Instagram, Facebook, and different social media outlets and pull that information together and make an album for us. And I think that that is really going to be helpful, especially for people who don't necessarily have a photographer. So I think be flexible is one of our biggest things. And then also, if you are nervous about planning at all, this is almost certainly not the way to go because, for example, even last week we got an email from Airbnb saying that our venue had been canceled, and they were wonderful about it, very, very helpful, and it turns out that the host canceled it by accident, but definitely a few hours of panic there.
Yeah, it was not a comfortable email to receive.
You mean it was a mistake?
It was a mistake.
So all is fine now.
All is fine. Okay. Yeah.
All is fine. Fingers crossed. Yeah. It's going to be fine. We have chosen to believe.
Yeah. Okay. But I guess be flexible and don't be an anxious person.
Yeah.
Well, good luck. Best wishes. Keep us posted. Let us know how all goes, okay?
Thank you very much.
All right. And we are wishing you well. Kyle Healy and Nasekle Akweta joined us from our bureau in New York. Best wishes.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up, most Americans with any knowledge of history will have heard about how members of the civil rights movement were committed to nonviolence. But what you might not know is that some people interpreted that a little differently.
Guns kept people alive, kept communities safe, and all you have to do to understand this is simply think of black people as human beings, and they're going to respond to terrorism the way anybody else would.
Author Charles E. Cobb Jr. tells us about why some people said, "This nonviolent stuff will get you killed." That's the title of his new book, and we'll tell you more about it ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at LifeLock.com, code NPR. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
The Thoroughbreds will be running in the Belmont Stakes Saturday with a potential Triple Crown winner in the field. On the next Fresh Air, Donna Barton Brothers, a former jockey with 1,100 wins, tells us about life at the track, being a TV analyst, and about her mom, who got into fights with male jockeys when she got into racing. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA.
It made me feel very sad, very unwelcome. Since all this started happening, it's like, I don't think Fremont is where I want to be now. I don't think I want my kids to grow up in Fremont.
Latinos facing turmoil in Nebraska, America's heartland. That's this week on Latino USA.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, with instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, 50+, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start the first week of June. Details at yoga-cu.com or 344-YOGA.
This This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Summer is upon us, and so it's time for our regular summer reading series. Now, often when we think of books for this season, we think about beach-friendly novels full of adventure and romance. But since this year marks the 50th anniversary of many pivotal events in the civil rights movement, so-called Freedom Summer, we decided to dive into books that explore the theme of freedom. And we're going to start with one of the cornerstones of the movement, nonviolent resistance. You will have seen this in countless old news clips and even depicted in movies like The Butler. You'll have seen activists courageously withstanding abuse by fellow citizens and law enforcement. But what you did not see and might not have known about until now is that passive resistance in public protest did not necessarily mean an unwillingness to use force to protect themselves from violence in other circumstances. This hiding in plain sight story is recounted by the author, Professor Charles E. Cobb Jr. in his new book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. And Professor Cobb is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
What gave you the idea for this book? Or for this history, really, to kind of dig into this?
Well, as a writer, I'm very much concerned with how the history of the Southern freedom movement or civil rights movement is portrayed. And I'm very conscious of the gaps in the history. And one important gap in the history, in the portrayal of the movement, is the role of guns in the movement. I worked in the South. I lived with families in the South. There was never a family I stayed with that didn't have a gun. I know from personal experience and the experiences of others that guns kept people alive, kept communities safe, and all you have to do to understand this is simply think of black people as human beings and they're going to respond to terrorism the way anybody else would.
Now, early in the book, you start off explaining how guns became an important part of Southern culture. The fact is that during this era of kind of intense repression, blacks were specifically forbidden from having guns previously, and those were among the things that they sought to acquire. How is that important, or why did that become important?
Well, first, I would say that right from the beginning of the country's history, going all the way back, say, to the Jamestown colony in the 17th century and the days of slavery, guns and weapons were forbidden to black people. I mean, weapons, for obvious reasons, are associated with rebellion, and one of the big fears in the South was slave rebellion. After the Civil War, guns were, you had all these black soldiers who had fought in the Union Army coming back home with weapons. So states, particularly in what's called the First Reconstruction, attempted to disarm blacks, and that was not all that successful. You see, if we were really doing a deep look at this period, say, between the end of the Civil War and the start of World War I, you'd see instance after instance of blacks in the rural South fending off the Ku Klux Klan and others with weapons. It's the period what historian Vincent Harding, who just passed away, called the period of great black protests.
Mm. You talk a lot about, in fact, the role of wartime experience in changing how black people felt about themselves and their ability to use guns, if necessary, to defend themselves and their dignity. Do you want to tell the story of a black man named Benny Montgomery?
Benny Montgomery came out of the Army, and he was really mentally damaged in the fighting. He had a steel plate in his head, and he got in an argument with the farmer he was working for, which turned into a fist fight, and Benny Montgomery reached into his pocket and pulled out a knife and slit the farmer's throat and killed him. And he gets arrested. He's tried. He's executed in Raleigh, North Carolina, the state capital. Well, when the body is shipped back home, the Ku Klux Klan, which is angry that they hadn't been given the body in the first place, threatens the funeral director, saying that if you don't turn over the body to us, we'll kill you. If you dress Benny Montgomery's body in a uniform, we'll kill you. And if you drape an American flag over the coffin, as is traditional in the funerals of veterans, we'll kill you. Mm-hmm. So what happened was other veterans, led by Robert Williams, the most prominent of them later on, mounted an armed guard to defend the funeral parlor, the funeral director, and Benny Montgomery's body. So when the Klan showed up, there were two dozen men with rifles and pistols standing in front of the funeral parlor. And all they had to do was point their weapons at the Klansmen, and the Klan fled.
Why do you think we don't know more stories like this?
Well, I think because the story of black people in general and the civil rights movement in the United States is incompletely told. So there's a lot we don't know. And the movement, meaning the Southern Freedom Movement, has become so defined. The narrative of the movement has become so defined by nonviolence that anything presented outside of that narrative framework really isn't paid much attention to. I like the quip that Julian Bond made when I was talking to him about this book. He told me that really the way the public understands the civil rights movement can be boiled down to one sentence. Rosa sat down, Martin stood up, then the white folks saw the light and saved the day.
Speaking of Martin, Luther King Jr.,
yeah,
you present a very different picture of his attitude about this than I think other people might have seen, right? What was his attitude about the use of weapons?
It depends on when you, if you look at the early period of his leadership in the civil rights movement, particularly the period of the Montgomery bus boycott, his household, as one person noted, was an arsenal. There were guns all over the place. William Worthy, who was a journalist, sat down in an armchair, tried to sit down in an armchair in Martin King's house and was warned by Bayard Rustin, who was with him, that he was about to sit down on a couple of guns. King was a man of the South, after all, and he responded to terrorism. He responded to violence the way most people in the South would be inclined to respond. So when the Klan blew up his house in 1956, bombed his house in 1956, he went to the sheriff's office and applied for a gun permit to carry a concealed weapon. Now, he didn't get the permit, and if Bayard Rustin was still alive, he would, in this conversation, step in and say, yes, I was the guy who brought Martin Luther King to a complete understanding of nonviolence. But Martin King always acknowledged, if you read his writings, the right to self-defense, armed self-defense.
So what then happened? I mean, so he initially, he had weapons like other heads of households did, right?
Yeah, and it's not clear whether.
So what happened later? Did he divest himself of his personal weapons, or was it?
I think he did.
Other people then take up the challenge of defending or protecting his family, or what happened?
Yes,
there?
Other people protected his family, and other people protected him. Go talk to people in Birmingham. There are people there who right now can tell you they remember carrying a pistol or pistols to protect Martin Luther King. I mean, there were always people around Martin Luther King. Sometimes he didn't even know who they were, but there were always people around Martin Luther King with weapons prepared to use them. Remember, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, he was assassinated from somebody in hiding in a boarding house across the street, virtually an impossible situation to protect somebody from. If you can kill John Kennedy, of course you can kill Martin Luther King.
You also make the point in the book, though, that women also, there were women who were willing to defend themselves as well. In fact, you quote one of them at the very beginning of the book, Cynthia Washington, former field secretary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, yeah. SNCC. And you quote her as saying, do you want to read it? Do you have it with you?
I can whip it out real quick.
Go ahead. Let's read. I want to hear it.
And she says this. I'll read the whole thing. She says, I never was a true believer in nonviolence, but was willing to go along with it for the sake of the strategy and goals. However, we heard that James Cheney had been beaten to death before they shot him. The thought of being beat up, jailed, or even being shot was one kind of thing. The thought of being beaten to death without being able to fight back put the fear of God in me. Also, I was my mother's only child and with some responsibility to go home in relatively one piece, and I decided that it would be an unforgivable sin to willingly let someone kill my mother's only child without a fight. So I acquired an automatic handgun to sit in the top of that outstanding black patent and tan leather handbag that I carried. I don't think that I ever had to fire it. I never shot anyone, but the potential was there. And I still would hurt anyone, if necessary, to protect my son and grandson and his wife.
How do you think this changes, you're putting this out there, changes the way we think of that era?
Well, I don't think it, you know, it fleshes out the history. It helps you understand participants in the movement as human beings. You know, one of my problems with the way the history is portrayed is the people involved are held up as some extraordinary, almost angelic kind of group of people. And they're where what really needs to be understood is that they're ordinary people, ordinary human beings. They have the contradictions of anybody else, even Martin Luther King. Then people understand, people today understand the people of the 1950s, the 1960s more completely as human beings.
Professor Kahlo, don't you think that some people will look at this and say these people were hypocrites? They say that they were nonviolent, but they really weren't. That they, well, this was part of the PR, and it's just not true. That the image that we have of that era is just not true. What do you say to that?
I say that people never said they were nonviolent. People said they were in the nonviolent movement, or they said they were in the freedom movement. Martin Luther King declared himself nonviolent. So did Jim Lawson, who mentored the Nashville students, or Bayard Rustin, who organized the March on Washington. But the typical person in the South involved with the Southern freedom movement really didn't use the labels that are attached to them, militant, nonviolent, you know, violent. My friend Worth Long, who was active with SNCC, uses the term unviolent to describe
unviolent.
People.
Interesting.
In the movement. He says, because what's the choice? How do you describe somebody who's a part of a nonviolent movement but really isn't philosophically committed to nonviolence? Or better yet, here's an example. Hartman Turnbull, a legendary figure in Mississippi's movement. When he drove the Knight Riders away one night with his rifle, and if the rumor is true, he even killed one of them. So when we showed up the next morning, Mr. Turnbull, who was a farmer, said, and this is an exact quote, "I wasn't being nonviolent. I was just protecting my family."
Hmm. Charles E. Cobb Jr. is an author, professor, and activist. His latest book is This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. And he joined us from Jacksonville, Florida. Professor Cobb, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me here.
We'd like to end today with a regular feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we invite some of our guests to tell us about the top songs on their playlists. Today we hear from a Brit in Baltimore. Award-winning playwright and actor Kwame Kwe Arama is the artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage Theater. When we caught up with him to talk about making a life and making art across the pond, he also shared the music that helps him relax from the rigors of the transatlantic life.
My name is Kwame Kwe Arama, and in my ear right now is Bob Marley's So Much Trouble in the World.
So much trouble in the world. So much trouble in the world. Bless my eyes this morning. Just sun is on the rise once again.
There's something about So Much Trouble in the World. There's something about the melancholy that's deep in its DNA. There's something about the yearning to heal the world. There's something even in just the chord structure that just allows me to feel challenged and warm and inspired. It's just one of my favorite Bob Marley songs. Robert Glasper, Experiment, Afro Blue.
Shades of delight, call you, rich as the night.
And I love Robert Glasper because he's like old school jazz and new school jazz and tomorrow's jazz and R&B, and it's just, it's modern day Miles Davis. In my ear, Roberto Flack's Killing Me Softly. I'm listening to that because Roberto's voice is just simply magnificent, and it calms me.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see him to listen for a while. And then
that was theater director Kwame Kwe Arama telling us what's playing in his ear. To hear our previous conversation with him, head over to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and go to Tell Me More.
Killing me softly with his song. Killing me softly.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.